Hello, and welcome to the SAM BioSketch series, where we talk with leaders from across emergency medicine about their work in emergency medicine research and advice that they can have for us. We're excited to have with us Dr. Caitlin Reyes, an instructor at the Yale Department of Emergency Medicine and co-director of Yale Emergency Scholars Fellowship. Did I get it right that time?
You got it right.
For a little context there, I've now mispronounced Dr. Reyes's name multiple times. But anyway, thank you for joining us. My name is Cole Ettinghoff. I'm a medical student at Tel Aviv University and a member of the SAM Research Committee. Dr. Reyes, do you want to just start with a little introduction of yourself and your work?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Dr. Reyes. I'm here at Yale in New Haven, Connecticut. I conduct research regarding health outcomes among patients experiencing homelessness. And I combine the methodologies of health services research with political epidemiology and community engaged research to do that. A little about myself, I came to medicine in sort of a longer path. I was a psychology major in undergrad and had no thoughts whatsoever of becoming a doctor. And I got really interested in public health and ended up in grad school at Columbia University's Mellon School of Public Health, And my concentration at that time was socio-medical sciences. And I was at that time in the research track. And my plan had been to get a PhD and do a bunch of public health research. So I went on to do that. And I had field projects in lots of global health settings and took a job at Oxford doing that kind of work. And in all my field work, I kind of came to this realization that I did want to be a physician and that that was the sort of approach that I wanted to have to my research career. And so I went back to school and did one of those post-bac programs and found myself at Brown for medical school. And I've always kind of done work with vulnerable populations. And so my interests have often been, you know, my projects are centered on things like intimate partner violence or asylum seeking or negotiating HIV testing with spouses of migrant workers. And so when I got to Brown, I sort of started working in the space of disaster medicine and ethics and sort of resource allocation, specifically ventilators, which I had no idea was going to become so relevant in my early career. And from there, I went to Yale for my residency. And at the time, I thought I was actually going to go, there was like this brief period of time where I thought I was going to actually go into community medicine and do a bunch of advocacy stuff, thinking that was my way of being a change maker. But I realized that I am indeed a big nerd and that research was always going to be my path. And I actually did the program that I am now the director for, which is the Yale Emergency Scholars Fellowship, which sort of combines fellowship with your residency program, sort of a hybrid where like a 4+2=5 kind of thing. And I started working more and more with sort of the unsheltered and unhoused community and like people working in that space within the city. And that kind of became my niche. And now that's where I'm working. And now I'm here as faculty and I've signed my life away to Yale. And that was my path.
Awesome. Sounds like a really incredible path. We actually hear from a lot of our ER docs how, you know, we found other passions and we found them that had a really nice interface with medicine in the UD. And it's exciting to see that public health and social medicine can really have a vibrant place in so many of our UDs. And you've done so much along the way. It's really incredible to hear that journey. I think you really gave us a great elucidation as to how you got started in that path and the role that research played even before your time in emergency medicine. I guess during that time of residency and sort of early on when you were really focused on your clinical training, how did you find, other than the decision to enroll in a fellowship program, how did you find the sort of bandwidth to engage in research?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was very different actually going from the research world to re-entering school as a medical trainee. You know, there's so much that it's really important at the end of the day that you're a good doctor and that you learn good clinical practice, right? So that was definitely my priority, you know, all through med school and through residency. In terms of finding that time, I think that it's really important if you're interested in a research career to focus on something you're really passionate about. You have to have that fire in your belly or you're not going to want to do it. If you're working an 80-hour week, you're not going to find time to like polish up an abstract if you are not already really into it. And so I think that that's where I would, even just telling people who are just sort of checking the box of your research requirement, do something that you care about. Do something that, you know, you want to get out of bed for. Yeah.
Well, that concept of sort of checking the box on our research project. So many of us, some of the questions we get are like, well, I have to do this scholarly activity. What can I do that won't hurt too much? But it's exciting to hear people who do that and then really find things they're interested and excited about. You mentioned this idea of passion. I want to go back to that for a second and talk a little bit more about your passion for that sort of intersection of medicine and public health at BED. Ideally, over the next few years, what kinds of things would you like to be working on to see that passion grow?
So I'm really interested in, like, oh, sorry, just to clarify, you mean like my passion for whatever my niche is?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, great. Yeah, I mean, I think what I'm really interested in is this concept of political epidemiology and using sort of the tools of epidemiology and causal inference to measure the health outcomes as they relate to various social and political changes. I'm sure everyone's tired of talking about COVID, or we're all tired of COVID. But one of the things that I've found really fascinating and why I gravitated towards disaster medicine and medical school as well is that these times of major disruption from a disaster, a pandemic, often lead to programs that otherwise would not have the social and political will to implement. So in what I worked in is like housing, we did a lot of really novel stuff for economic security and people's housing security during the pandemic that we otherwise wouldn't have done. And it creates this really fascinating landscape of natural experiments to look at those and say, okay, well, this is a terrible thing that happened, but what's something we want to take forward? Maybe we've learned that we don't want people to live in shelters just on cots, body to body, and that people deserve to have, you know, single occupancy structures for temporary shelter. Or maybe we've learned that, you know, eviction isn't something we should be having as a society, you know, or child tax credits, all these kinds of things that emerge out of that we have the opportunity to keep if there's some outcome that we care about.
I think this leads into what is kind of a loaded question. It isn't necessarily meant to be a loaded question, but obviously you had a big background in public health prior to going into medicine. How is your training and your experience as a physician allow you to do this kind of public health work in a way that you wouldn't have been able to with just that public health background?
So many ways. I think especially as I'm interested in health services research, right? And how often people need the ED. For example, some of the outcomes I'm interested in are like, you know, use of the ED for opioid overdoses or psychiatric emergencies, you know, and why they use the ED as opposed to outpatient, or what is sort of the mechanism by which that happens. And when you're collecting your data and you're analyzing it, I don't think that I would understand how to design my studies or how to interpret so much of what creates the electronic health record without being a provider, right? And understanding, you know, if you're going to pull something from like ICD codes, right? Understanding how you come to put an ICD code in chart, right? Understanding what a nurse triage note means, like what's a normal thing to look for that, where in this workflow you might actually implement a change, where you're going to get pushback, understanding those players. It's a very privileged space to be an emergency medicine provider. And I'm really glad to have that insight in my research.
Interesting. So the other question that we get a lot is, what makes this emergency medicine research? Why is this relevant to an emergency medicine department or to an department that's trying to prove that research really is a thing that happens with an EM?
Well, for me, I mean, my outcomes are ED use and a lot of that sort of administrative data. And I think that right now, you know, when we're looking at a national boarding crisis, it's a good question to ask, like, what are the drivers of frequent use? You know, what are the outcomes in society that maybe our community partners can help us with that would better serve our patients' needs and then minimize the demand on the ED? I don't want to like ever say that what someone considers an emergency and brings them to our doorstep isn't an emergency. That's for them to decide. We're here for them, right? But maybe there are things that can help them more sustainably than we can.
Great point. And I think you hit on that notion of utilization and sort of the cost element that goes into that. One of the things that we hear a lot from our social EM friends is that sometimes they have a hard time advocating for research in this space if they can't demonstrate how this is going to save money to a hospital or to an insurance provider, something like that. Did you struggle to find funding, particularly early on in your career?
I think that funding is something everyone is seeking always, right? I didn't struggle. I don't want to say I didn't struggle. What I want to say is that I was fortunate enough to be doing a program that sort of obviated that need in a lot of ways. I'm only in my first year as faculty, right? But I was a resident and as a fellow, wow. And being part of this novel program that sort of had a research track that resulted in what I guess you could consider protected time as a resident for my research. I wasn't needing to buy my time, right? So I could spend that time really developing my skills, you know, publishing and developing my research portfolio and deliverables so that now when I'm junior faculty applying for funding, I feel more supported and more competitive, therefore.
Very cool. How much of your time now is spent clinically versus on dedicated research time?
Well, you know, there are a lot of debates on what the denominator is in academic medicine. So I'm probably somewhere in the ballpark of 75% to 50%, and that fluctuates. So, for example, I'm early in my career, so I'm looking at K-awards, which require 75% of my time be research. So if I land one of those, that will change. And yeah, I'm putting that out there since it's instructional for people embarking on this path.
Yeah. So you mentioned how being at a program that had a significant support for folks who are interested in research really mattered and helped you get started there. I think particularly when we look at our medical students who are looking at residencies and they're debating, you know, I want to make research part of my career. Do I need to be at a big name institution that has big dollars or big support behind research? What kind of things should residents be looking for in a program that's going to be able to support them getting started in research?
Well, shameless plug, we have this Yale Emergency Scholars Program. So if you're interested in a combined research fellowship and residency, please feel free to reach out to me. And I'm now the co-director of that program that I just mentioned that I did. I think that the sort of key ingredients to incorporating research into your residency is mentorship. The mentorship can go a really long way. Having someone who's going to like take you under their wing, show you the ropes, teach you the hidden curriculum, help you get your sort of starter portfolio going, you know, your first couple publications, analyzing your first data set, whatever that is for you. Having someone who's really going to turn your paper red with track changes and roll up their sleeves and invest in you. That's what you want to find. I think at the level of residency, it's important to think about things that are going to be able to be completed on your timeline, and having someone who is within your department and looking out for you and knows kind of all the things that you're taking on are really important. I will say, I think that there's something to be said for large research institutions because, you know, you will have faculty who have access to data sets or analysts or research assistants that you can kind of jump on. That's not to say you can't do it in any other setting either. I will say that probably does facilitate things though, just having sort of the research machinery that.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And I think when we look at research fellowships across the country, a lot of those programs are starting to become unfilled in addition to bigger conversations about EM residencies in general being unfilled. What do you think are some of the things that scare people away from careers within EM research?
Well, I think that, you know, it's ambiguous what you're getting out of a research fellowship, right? It's a lot about what you need and what you want to get out of that. It's, you have to be very proactive because research is such a broad term. And I think that a lot of medical students and residents maybe don't come from strong research backgrounds, so that to take on a research fellowship, you know, you're really starting from the ground. And so I think that it can feel like, do I need to do this in a fellowship or can I do this as a junior faculty with lots of support and mentorship? I would suggest doing the fellowship, even though we all want to pay off our loans and get on to the real job. Fellowship really gives you this protected period of time to develop. There are often dedicated funds for you to take courses, to develop your skills. You know, everyone is still just expecting you to be becoming your salary, your job, and all those expectations that come with a faculty position aren't there. And you can take that opportunity to try some things, take some risks, and fail a little. And I think that's a really important step in the journey. I think that we don't talk enough about what the job entails with our residents. I think that when, I don't mean at Yale, but I think in general, residency doesn't really cover what academic medicine really is, right? What the grants are, what teaching, how teaching factors in, what the promotions look like. And so I think that that's another reason why maybe we're not seeing as much going into that. Yeah, I'm not sure. That wasn't the most articulate answer. Sorry.
No, it's beautiful. We love seeing you think through it. I think you hit on, you know, this grants concept, the publications concept. And when we talk to researchers, sometimes we share different metrics of what it means to be a quote successful researcher. Is it the, you know, I've been funded by the NIH for 20 years? Is it I've got however many hundreds of articles, or I've spoken however many conferences? What does being a successful researcher look like from your perspective?
Yeah, my perspective, this may not be my boss's perspective or, you know, whoever's on Twitter's perspective, but from my perspective, good research changes things. It changes policy, or it changes the way we practice, or it changes the healthcare system. No one cares about an article that was published in, you know,
wherever,
right, that no one ever reads, that didn't affect anything. You know, there's sometimes things where you're like, oh, well, that's interesting. And then you move on and nothing ever changes from it, right? It was just an interesting finding. And there's a place for all that too. But for me, like, success is taking that out of the academy and taking that into communities and seeing a real transformation.
Which I think ties really nicely into the work that you've done. And love to ask a couple of questions just sort of specifically about your work within sort of this broader umbrella of social emergency medicine, public health medicine, however you want to call it, if you want to frame it. I know that there are those who push back and say that, you know, social emergency medicine is sort of an adjunct. It's not core to what we do in emergency medicine. What do you say to folks who ask those kinds of questions of, is this really something that we should be thinking about or focusing on within the walls of the UT? Isn't our job already big enough?
I mean, I would say that whether it was by accident or by design, the emergency department is both in the House of Medicine and in the social safety net. It has to serve both these roles. If we're going to stay up all night and say, we're here for you 24/7, 365, no matter who you are, what's wrong with you?
Right.
That just by being that nature of service, we are engaging with the most vulnerable people in society. And this is what they bring to the doorstep. You know, that's what we signed up for in a lot of ways. And I do think that we are in a really special place to advocate, because we see how the injustices of society actually inflict damage on the bodies of our patients. And I don't think that we can say that our jobs start when it becomes medical.
Yeah, I love that notion of the ER being sort of the ultimate safety net, like the only part of medicine that under any time, under any circumstances, will at least do an assessment. I know we're running tight on time here, but I want to leave us with a couple of questions here. One of these is one of my favorite questions to ask. Now, obviously, we've got all kinds of limits of funding, of time, of other resources. But in a world in which resources were not limited, what kind of projects would you be interested in focusing on over the next couple of years?
I mean, in an unlimited world, I would love to be able to do like RCTs with housing policies, anti-poverty policies, and see how that transforms, you know, the engagement with the healthcare system. Yeah. I mean, I think that when it comes to it, like, I really just want, I'm still very public health minded. I want to just make these population changes.
I love it. It's such a fun note. Perhaps we should have ended on that one. But I guess the question I want to end with, maybe a little more serious. I think particularly when we talk about sort of the socially and public health side of emergency medicine, we hear a lot of physicians and leaders who get frustrated, who feel like we're fighting an uphill battle, that some of the things are beyond the control of emergency medicine or even the hospital or the ED. I guess, what keeps you motivated to keep doing these challenges? And what do you think is going to keep you motivated in 10, 20, 30 years?
I think that the part that keeps me able to show up and, you know, kind of shout against the brick wall, which it can feel like sometimes, that exercise and futility, is then sort of my community engagement side. I think that for people who really want to engage in social emergency medicine, having community partners just grounds you, and you actually get to see some of that work happening among your colleagues, you know, following local politics and, you know, various like grants from health and human services or something like that. And really seeing that upstream connection is what makes it for me. I don't necessarily expect the ED itself to solve these problems. So watching them get taken care of in my community helps me show up for my part.
I love that. I know I said that was going to be my last question, but I lied. You talked about, you know, integrating this into HHS functions and sort of the grant-driven cycle of this and trying to build this into things that'll outlive us, right? And will make truly a meaningful impact in the communities we serve. How do we institutionalize some of these things? How do we go from social change projects that sort of come and go based on whatever the political theme of the day is, whatever the funding priority is of the day, into things that can be really sustainable, lasting change?
Well,
that's a big question, a really hard one to answer.
Not sure I have the answer to that. I mean, I think that creating sustainable work is important. And I think that, again, touches back on having community partners. You know, I don't ever want to be the rate limiting step on this kind of stuff, to be for my research to be the thing that I'm driving. And if I'm not doing it, it doesn't happen. I like to know that I'm working on a team of people that if I faded out, it would go on. And I think that, you know, grants come and go for research, but community programs, they have people committed to them, like, because people are really depending on them for their material needs, for their jobs, for their kids. Those are things I want to engage with and I want to build and I want to make them, you know, financially viable and stable. You know, I don't know if that answers the question.
At least gives us somewhere to start.
Somewhere to look. Yeah. Right.
Thank you so much again for taking the time to talk with us and for all you do across not only emergency medicine, but public health and the larger sphere of social services.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
And thank you to everyone who joined us for this SAM BioSketch series. Fun fact, this will actually be our last episode of the SAM BioSketch series as this effort gets folded into the larger research learning series sponsored by the SAM Research Committee. So be sure to look for upcoming episodes of the Research Learning Series, or RLS, on the SAM website, which will also be cross-posted to YouTube. Thank you so much.